Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Daily Friends Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Sholin Boysen. Sholin, how are you doing?
Hey, Nick, I'm doing good. We had a very eventful political day yesterday, so I'm excited to get into the conversation regarding that.
Indeed, indeed. And we're also joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's nice to see a young person like Sholin with, what's the word, hope.
Yes, well, there is a reason to be gloomy, which is that at incredible lightning speed, and you wonder if it would be useful for government to demonstrate this speed in other areas. The expropriation bill has been passed through the National Assembly about a week after it was passed through committee. So the day before that, we had the Land Courts Bill being pushed through the National Assembly, and yesterday we had the expropriation bill, and together these two pieces of legislation create an extremely fraught environment for prosperity and property rights in South Africa. We'll get into that in a second. I just want to go over a bit of the events of yesterday. So within Parliament, the DA, IFP, Freedom Front Plus, and ACDP all objected to the bill, as did the EFF, although for completely different reasons. So while all of the other opposition parties objected to the bill because they said that it was damaging to human rights and destroying property rights and allowing abuse by government, all those things. The EFF said that it was outrageous that this bill did not go far enough, to quote their MP who spoke in the debate. Why is the ANC playing with people's emotions and claiming to be for expropriation of land when they want to expropriate land that is of little value or of no value at all to our people? This bill would leave land owned by whites untouched. That's the EFF for you. They were upset at the fact that the bill allowed compensation in some circumstances, and therefore they voted against it. Although I suspect the real reasons were more to do with causing chaos inside the ANC. So the Minister of Public Works, Patricia de Lille, who is allegedly an opposition party from the Good Party, but is clearly not, she said that the expropriation bill makes explicit what is implicit in the Constitution. Expropriation of property with nil compensation is not a silver bullet to solve land problems. Expropriation is only one acquisition mechanism that is appropriate in certain cases for public interest and will enable land reform and redress. The bill does not prescribe nil compensation will be paid in these other cases. She said it also had to be approved by a court of law, but of course she's playing a bit of a sleight of hand there because this is going to be dealt with in the land courts as well. And then de Lille criticized various organizations, including us, I suppose, for saying that the government will be able to arbitrarily take people's property, such as their homes, and saying that it was extremely dangerous to say such misleading things. The ANC supported, of course, the bill, saying that it was completely constitutional and there was nothing to see here. The DA's Samantha Graham-Murray said, in spite of this, the ANC has insisted that the exact clause that they have failed to pass be retained in the expropriation bill. She's referring to the failure to pass the constitutional amendment. It is our contention that is a brazen attempt by the governing party to amend the Constitution through the back door using ordinary legislation. It cannot be countenanced that a clause that was deemed so pivotal as to require constitutional amendment should now be adopted in the House by a simple majority. She said that Section 12(3) of the expropriation bill clearly contravenes the Constitution by providing specific instances where no compensation was already deemed to be just and equitable. So the DA put forward a number of amendments which would have taken the particularly toxic pieces of the expropriation bill out, and unsurprisingly, they were defeated by the ANC in Parliament. The Freedom Front Plus's Peter Groenewald also attacked it, saying the price of the bill is the destruction of the economy of South Africa because private ownership is one of the pillars of democracy and a free market economy. He said the expropriation bill should instead be called the destruction bill. So, a difficult day, I think, for a lot of reasons. It now goes to the National Council of Provinces, where it will be voted on again, and if it passes there, it will be made into legislation. Herman, let me start with you. What's your take on all this? Why did the ANC move so quickly on this? Often cases, they drag their feet. They take a very long time to get through all these parliamentary processes. But this time, they rushed.
So, I mean, there are a few possible considerations or reasons, or any one of these, or a combination of them. Firstly, the state is in dire fiscal strait. So there is this possibility that it is, asset poor in any real sense. So it is a way to get the government to a place where it can seize assets. Now, that danger was significantly greater under the previous version of this bill, which didn't make it expressly about immovable property land. But this bill does, in fact. So that argument of, it might be an asset grab diminishes a bit, but doesn't completely go away. Second possibility is, of course, that the ANC is panicking and that it needs to implement ideologically what it believes would genuinely be in the interest of the nation, that, get this expropriation bill done before 2024, so that we can start fixing the country. Now, of course, there's another component very closely related to that, another component consideration, and that is that, let's get the looting powers quickly before we lose power in 2024, so that, let's get what we can while we're at it.
My theory, I think, is that all of this is driven by internal ANC politics at the moment.
Yes. Yeah,
including why the EFF opposed it, because I think the EFF is trying to destabilize the leadership of the ANC so that if they form a coalition with them, they can essentially take over from the inside. So my thought is that the reason this was pushed through so quickly is Ramaphosa is under a huge amount of pressure now. He's facing a revolt in KZN once again. He's got the Palapala scandal over his head, which is seriously sort of bleeding him, because he's still not able to properly kind of fend it off. He just sort of flails about and runs away whenever it's brought up.
Yeah.
And so bringing this, the ANC resolved at its last elective conference that it was very important to pursue expropriation without compensation at full steam. And so now, by getting through the framework that will allow this, he can go back to the ANC's elective conference and say, hey, comrades, look, I did it.
I claim a win. I claim a win.
Exactly.
And I think also what we should recognize about this, that it is, I mean, Patricia de Lille is just straight up lying about this. No two ways about it. She's either dishonest or fundamentally ignorant, because this does not make explicit that which is implicit. The problem is that this bill creates an infinite list of circumstances under which expropriation without compensation can occur, because it doesn't give us a closed list of circumstances. That's one of the basic elements of reading a piece of legislation. Do you have a closed list or do you have an open list? And this is an open list of circumstances under which EWC can occur. So it's these and others is the sort of proper reading. And the idea that it makes explicit that which is implicit by maintaining many of the 1975 ministerial governmental rights or capacities or functions in the minister, as this bill does, just shows that as much as these people care about the Constitution, they couldn't care less about it when they legislate, because the 1975 bill and this bill shares significant chunks without taking into account that the 1975 bill was passed under parliamentary sovereignty and this one not. So, I mean, Patricia de Lille, genuinely, I like your description of her as sort of an alleged opposition politician. I hesitate to go further in fear of litigation, but she's an absolute liar.
Sherlyn, you're even younger than Herman and I. We're not exactly ancient ourselves, but you've got even more time ahead of you. And as a younger South African, I mean, does this give you pause for the future? What's your take on this whole piece of legislation? We're going to obviously fight it through the NCOP and the courts and things, but imagine for a second a future where the expropriation bill is not just adopted but implemented, and what are your thoughts about how that will affect the future?
Yeah, no, Nick. Generally, this is such a bad idea. One of my biggest issues, I think, with the expropriation bill in its total is that it gives so much power to one specific individual, who is the Minister of Public Works, Patricia de Lille, to have this type of influence over like land that's expropriated. Something interesting that she actually makes in Parliament yesterday is where she said, like, you know what, expropriation, it's not such a unique thing in the world. It happens in the United Kingdom, in New Zealand, in the United States. But I think it's interesting that she leaves out examples like Zimbabwe or Venezuela where this has occurred. She even went as far as saying, like, but it even happens in Singapore and look how prosperous they are. And I'm like, when you have the ANC as our ruling party, I have one question. Which direction do you guys think we will be going? The route of Zimbabwe or the route of Singapore? And I mean, one thing we know is that in places like Venezuela or Zimbabwe, where this has been tried out, it has only led to like the enrichment of not the ordinary people that these individuals like the ANC claim to fight for, but it was actually for the political elite who were in power at that point. And one thing we know about the ANC is how much they actually love self-enrichment. And as a young individual, and I know many people will have this idea as well, where, you know what, any investment that you make in this country, whether you buy a home or a car or whatever, even just the potential thought that the government can come and take that away, you know, without even giving complete necessary reasons, that is not a lot of faith that you can put into your country to know that the investment or the things you've worked for will remain yours. And it will be up to the government to decide. And one thing that I'm really annoyed by is that many, whether it's the banks, many of these people who know the effects that this could have on the economy, the silence that they have, have not been speaking out enough against the risks that this place for not only for our economy, but also for ordinary individuals. Because in many cases, the land will be given into the hands of the state, and it will not be given in the form of title deeds to ordinary citizens. Sorry, Arman.
Yeah, and to add to that, that the only one property has to be expropriated under this act for the asset values of the banks to collapse. Because the value of an asset, especially movable assets on the books of the banks, is based on their perceived market value. Market value is a result of the desire and for people to own that particular piece of property. If you fundamentally undermine the desire to own property by introducing this uncertainty into the system that you cannot securely own property, that immediately cuts some value of your assets. And we, in terms of financial crisis, the banks in South Africa need only a fractional devaluation of their immovable asset books for a possible full-scale banking crisis and financial crisis to South Africa, because they might lose literally billions of rands in asset value just being wiped out and becoming short on capital or undercapitalized, triggering a local 2008-2009 economic crisis. So the silence of the banks, as you say, sure, it's embarrassing. It's disgusting.
And another thing I wanted to say is that anybody who after this has any guts to be like our current president, Ramaphosa, is this brilliant businessman, and you know he's this genius reformer that's using brilliant tactics. Anybody who has the nerve to come with that argument, the argument has completely fallen flat, I think, because what Ramaphosa, he hasn't reformed anything. He's actually spearheading a destructive ANC policy. And another point that I think is probably the most important one, Nick, for why this is going through, like yourself and Armand mentioned, is actually the ANC's elective conference happening. Is it in December, I think? And that he needs to go there. I mean, Palapala's on his head. Eskom CEO is currently talking about stage 15 load shedding. These are not a good look for him going into that. And also now he supports Tshisekedi going into this. So he needs this win. He needs to be like, guys, look here, I promised expropriation without compensation. Look here, this is what we got. We brought it to you guys. And the collapse of the economy. But don't worry, we brought you guys expropriation. That's what this guy needs to stay president going forward. That's really unfortunate, Nicholas.
Yeah, I must say, it's just interesting to see how all-consumed the ANC has become by its own internal squabbles. It's very difficult to see almost any action the ANC takes at this point that isn't in some way about internal fighting in the party or maneuvering for position, that kind of thing. And that means continuing to put the foot on the accelerator of the ideological slide of the country towards dysfunction. All right, let's move on to our next story. We're going back again to the troubled city of Joburg Council, where the rogue COPE councillor, Colleen Makabule, has been elected as Speaker of the Joburg Council. So what seemed to have happened here is that there was a sort of complicated series of events. So initially, the DA lost control of the speakership after a couple of councillors defected, including Colleen from the coalition because she was originally part of it. She then declared herself the acting speaker, tried to hold a council sitting that was defeated in court. Eventually they did go to a council sitting, which was chaired by the acting city manager. And I'm not entirely sure of the sequence of events here, but there was a lot of a very aggressive negotiation prior to the vote amongst the coalition partners about, you know, whether this was an opportunity to shake things up or add more officers or kind of contribute to how things were going, to change the structure of the coalition agreement. And this saw the DA Gauteng leader apparently write an op-ed complaining about rent seeking from some parties to go to the Daily Mail. He wrote an op-ed that went to a couple of publications, and even though he says it was embargoed, it leaked from those publications.
Have we lost Nick?
Yeah, we might have.
Right, so this is a palace coup. No, so the opinion piece was in. Nick, are you back?
I think I'm back. I don't know what's wrong with my internet.
Right, that was a very short reign. I abdicate.
Apologies about that. Anyway, to cut a long story short there, because I don't know where I dropped off, the point is that at the end of the day, the PA defected from the coalition and it failed to secure a majority over the city council, and as a result.
They don't want Nick to speak about this, do they?
Yeah. David made a very important point saying that Nick has been expropriated.
Yes.
But he's back now.
Oh my goodness.
I think, Herman, you may need to take over now while I sort out what's going on my end here.
All right. Okay, cool. So what, and this embargoed piece was then found its way, leaked its way, trickled its way to some of the coalition parties and really got the cat amongst the pigeons, with the DA leader in Gauteng being essentially a setup by his own actions. Don't doubt that, but also the ability of the media to screw with any possible chance of opposition politics succeeding. But I mean, it was an unwise decision in the first place, causing massive unhappiness in the coalition partners in the lead up to this very significant vote. And when the vote came in, the DA's candidate, the coalition's candidate actually lost to Colleen Mangubane, and the most obvious switch we know of is the Patriotic Alliance. And this is genuinely, again, it's a warning bell. It's a warning bell that some coalition partners aren't worth trusting. I think it was Nick who, in a conversation before the podcast, made the point that in almost every case where the PA has ever gone into coalition, it has ended up screwing its coalition partners, whether it's been the ANC, whether it's been the DA, the Freedom Front Plus, the IFP. They are fundamentally unreliable coalition partner. And we must really face up to the fact that the greatest risk to an end to ANC government is these small, corrupt, these small, allegedly corrupt Mickey Mouse parties that manage to derail sensible government formation attempts. I'm looking at you, Al-Jamar. I'm looking at the ATM. I'm looking at the PA. I'm looking at you, good for nothing. And the problem here is voters can only so long be protected from their own decisions.
I'm not sure if I would entirely include the ATM in that list.
Not yet, but let's put them. Let's look at 2024 with provincial and national governance. I think the ATM. Let me put it this way: if the ATM is a reliable coalition partner, I will, after a reasonable amount of time, eat that mouse pad in 2025 or 2026. Timestamp on that. But yeah, it's just a massive warning. And it goes back to the fact that when these coalitions were formed after the elections last year, the DA and the coalition were really saddled with an unappealing situation where damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because if they didn't form a government, they would be handing over Johannesburg municipality to an ANC-led government. If they do form a government, they will get blamed for every failure, and constantly over their heads will be this threat of losing power when smaller parties misbehave. So I must say, coalition politics, my goodness, it's no silver bullet, but it is a bullet. But that bullet can, also land in a foot somewhere.
Trellin, your take on this?
Yeah, no, I really think that the DA has find themselves in a really tough position right now. Because firstly, they didn't support she's a co-councillor, if I remember correctly, Colleen Makabule. And now she's the speaker, and now the threat is literally there that she might be the one who, straight puts it on the agenda that there should be this vote of no confidence against Popalachi, who is the current Joburg mayor. And I mean, she has been vocal about not liking Popalachi for whatever her reasons may be. I also think that the dynamics that's behind the scene we don't really know the dynamics behind the scene, but I think it could have been some sort of avoiding the situation. I know Adman will most likely disagree with me on this, but I know that behind the scene that the PA and I think the Freedom Front Plus also wanted an IFP councillor instead of a DA councillor being placed as the candidate for the speaker, and the DA just refused. And Kenny Kunene, one of his statements was saying that no, we're not going to support this DA councillor because the DA already has the mayor seat and all of these important positions.
I'm going to push back there. I think anyone who has ever dealt with the IFP in the Johannesburg Metropolitan Council should know that the IFP is not...
Just a point of clarity, they wanted a deputy speaker position created.
Oh, okay.
So, but on my point, the IFP is a notoriously unreliable partner, specifically in Johannesburg, not across the bench, but its Johannesburg caucus has in many, many instances since 2016 simply not been a reliable partner. I completely, from a rational perspective, understand why an IFP specific position would be unappealing. And the idea that the DA refuses to share power, I mean, it's just fundamentally nonsense. You just don't then look at the MECs, look at the mayoral committees, see the portfolios allocated. And in fact, you can go back to the first coalition, DA-led coalition government in Cape Town, where they had a speaker from the Freedom Front Plus. So, I mean, it really is easy to score the cynical points, and no one is better at that than Gayton McKenzie and Julius Malema. But I think what this fundamentally shows is that if a coalition minority government is a fundamentally poisoned chalice. In Tswane, it's a different story because the coalition has a functional majority. But in Johannesburg and in Ekurhuleni, my word, it's a job I don't want.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, I mean, what we are seeing, especially in the Joburg council right now, will most likely going to reach the provincial level and eventually possibly national government level. So I'm like, we are in for a rather exciting ride, to put it nicely.
That's if a coalition is a minority government. That's if it, I think it would be a significantly more stable situation. Perhaps not, obviously not flawless, but a coalition minority government is, historically speaking, the most unstable government you could possibly imagine in a democratic system.
All right. Gentlemen, please let me know if my internet cuts out again, but I think I'm back. And for our last story here, I just want to cover something that particularly rubs me the wrong way. And this is our former President Thabo Mbeki, who was recently speaking at UNISA, where he once again reiterated some of his previous claims that HIV does not, in fact, cause AIDS. He was giving, he's the Chancellor of UNISA and was giving a long sort of address to a group there. And he said, causes of tuberculosis are known and historical, but it's not, but it's part of the syndrome. So you can't say one virus causes all of these illnesses. What you can say is that this virus impacts negatively on the immune system. It's that weakened immune system which results in a syndrome. But there's a consequence to that kind of thinking, which is you go to get the test. It says you have, you are HIV positive. It doesn't necessarily mean you've got the virus. What it means is that your immune system is responding to something that is threatening the body, and therefore you need a clinical analysis in order to determine what is the thing that the immune system is rejecting. It's in all the medical documents that go on about it, and it's correct, because then you have to go and do a clinical examination in order to determine which of these illnesses in the syndrome is the one that's affecting this person, and you treat the person for that particular disease. So it's not straight up AIDS denialism, I think, as bluntly as it previously was stated by the president, but it's pretty close to. And it's clear to me that he really hasn't changed his mind on the link between HIV and AIDS, the fact that the syndrome is caused by this virus. I know people who've died of AIDS, people who are quite close to me, and there are millions of South Africans who have the same experience. And I think it's worth perhaps reflecting for a moment on the staggering human cost of the denial of antiretroviral drugs from the state to ordinary South Africans. Sherlyn, what do you make of this?
Yeah, no, I do think that there is, like, I'm like, who wrote this guy's speech? Or who was even there to, like, you know, just like fact check it or give him some communications advice? Because in a country where, you know, there is a rather huge population of people who have HIV and AIDS, and for him to make statements like this again is really weird. And there's also just something about an ANC leader and bad sexual health advice, because a similar thing occurred with Jacob Zuma when he made a statement that he just like took a shower after whatever he was engaging with. And I'm like, these people are supposed to be representatives. They're supposed to be some of the best individuals
to be country. To be fair to Zuma, in terms of policy, he saved thousands of lives that Mbeki cut short, which is one of the great ironies of the fact that, anyway, go on.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct, Nick. But yeah, my thing is just like, these are supposed to be some of the you know, leading figures in our country, and yet they are just not making the cut, especially with comments that could have been simply avoided, like this one. But yeah, Nick.
Herman, just briefly before we close up, your thoughts.
It's politically stupid. I mean, just at the moment when Mbeki's political stock was starting to tick up, he was starting to emerge again as someone to take seriously within the ANC's commentariat, perhaps even broader society with all the necessary caveats, he bungles into this. So I must say, you know, he continues the well-established tradition of modern ANC leaders to never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
I'll just read a statement here from the Academy of Science of South Africa, which said, how disappointing then that former President Mbeki chose this moment to resurrect discredited propositions on HIV and AIDS. His administration's ambiguity on the role of HIV causing AIDS resulted in a decline of life expectancy from 62 years in 1994 to 52.5 years by 2005. His comments at UNISA will certainly fuel the latent stigma and denialism that health professionals, scientists, NGOs, and civil society have worked so hard to mitigate and place more than 5.5 million of the approximately 8 million patients living on HIV, living with HIV on long-term life-saving antiretroviral therapy. Yeah, bad stuff. But anyway, we're done for the week. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope that you found the show interesting, thought-provoking, all that good stuff. And we will be back next week on the Daily Print Show. Cheers, everyone.